All matter. He didn't care for celery, found its flavor peculiar, and so began leaving it out of his mirepoix at home, despite the teachings of his instructors. While training at the school, he worked as the brunch cook at the Empire Diner, a trendy Art Deco restaurant that combined coffee shop grub with creative cooking. Bronx boy Waltuck was plunged into a new, predominantly gay world. It was an eclectic group of people, and the chef was this guy named Sophronis Mundi. He had no restaurant experience, as far as I could tell. He was a private chef. He was Aaron Copeland's chef, or had been. The people that owned it had owned this place on the Upper West Side called Lascais. I'm pretty sure most of those people are dead now. This was pre-AIDS, so I'm sure a lot of them died in that epidemic. They were opening this thing that was supposed to be kind of a diner, but also a somewhat ambitious restaurant, in the sense that they had dinerish food, but then every night there was supposed to be a 4- or 5-course prefix menu that would change every day. And nobody was really in charge because Sophronis was in over his head. He used to go out to all the gay bars at night, and I would come in the morning, and he wouldn't be there. The food would start arriving. So I was thrust into this place where I had to kind of figure it out without a whole lot of support. And that was fun. I was doing stuff that I had no business doing in terms of designing the menu. This was doubly true because Waltuck was learning kitchen basics as he was creating those menus. All of a sudden, soft-shell crabs were there, and I had to ask somebody, "How do you clean soft-shell crabs?" Though Waltuck grew up in a place and time where gay was just like an insult that you called somebody, he adjusted quickly to the Empire scene, thought Mundi was a great guy. He had like 2 personalities, and he would go to his favorite bar, and he would roll in at like 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon the next day. In the summer of 1977, Waltuck, a shy string bean, began dating Karen Brown, a brassy free spirit capped by a Sally Bowles hairdo who worked in an East Side women's boutique. They were polar opposites in just about every way. Karen was more well-traveled than David, having spent extended time in Europe and South America, and was also fearlessly extroverted. They fell in love between meals at Café des Artistes, La Côte Basque, and Lutèce. Waltuck dropped out of the CIA, went to work for Charles Chevillot at La Petite Femme, a rustic French bistro on the Upper East Side. But he was bored there too, wanted to start rule-breaking. He and Karen, who had by then begun entertaining ideas of perhaps opening a restaurant with him, visited France, dined at Télévent in Paris. Karen was especially inspired by Fernand Poin's widow, Mado Poin, and by Magie Lacoz at the original Le Bernardin in Paris. Back in the United States, the Waltucks began hosting dinner parties in their studio apartment on East 77th Street. David cooked dishes such as lobster navarine in a cream sauce, squab mousse fortified with cognac, soft-shell crabs with sorrel, lobster with apple and cider, and rack of lamb with whole cloves of garlic and garlic jus. He also devised a seafood sausage, inspired by a reading of Télévent's Boudin des Fruits du Mer in a piece by Gail Green. There was real value in not having an internet. As a creative exercise, Waltuck often challenged himself to create dishes based on the names he'd see in print. The apartment essentially became a pop-up. Karen would procure flowers and shop for wines at 67 Wine and Spirits on Columbus Avenue. As it happened for so many of the 5 couples, guests began to echo a shared refrain, "You guys should open a restaurant." The Waltucks decided to give it a go, inspired in part by the Wines and Allison and Hubert. They hashed out a budget of $35,000, which would prove far too low, and went to work seeking a space, settling on a shuttered bodega in Soho, at the time an urban wasteland. They were there for budgetary reasons. The rent was just $850 per month. But the neighborhood, where artists lived legally in city-subsidized lofts or illegally in industrial buildings, brought out the rebel in them. Waltuck continued to essay dishes with abandon, while Karen staffed up her dining room with a cast of characters who could not have worked in Midtown restaurants, dancers, photographers, and other creatives, many boasting facial hair that would have been a deal-breaker north of Soho in the Village. She also hired women when there was scarcely a woman on any dining floor in town. At one point, a troupe of 4 dancers who lived together around the corner worked as servers. A number of aesthetic decisions were groundbreaking. Bill Katz, a designer of stage sets, came up with the name Chanterelle. Leaving off a le or la was itself considered audacious. And the Waltucks elected to write their menu, which Karen rendered by hand in a script that imitated Maudepois, in English, something that even the Quilted Giraffe didn't do in its earliest New York City incarnation. Katz also, as Allison and Hubert did before him, left the restaurant's windows unobstructed. Diners were one with the undeveloped environs that retained their 19th-century facades and cast-iron accents. The Waltucks hit a speed bump when they realized they were going to fall $30,000 short of what they'd need to open. In a moment that could have happened only in the 1970s in New York City, they were sitting in their job site late one evening when Susan and Louis Meisel, owners of a nearby art gallery, came by on roller skates, en route home from the Roxy nightclub. An impromptu conversation followed, and the Meisels arranged a dinner for investors in the restaurant space, securing the remaining funding. Chanterelle opened in November 1979, with 10 tables and no liquor license. The Waltucks didn't want art on the walls to distract from the food and their company. Katz came through again with the idea of featuring artwork on menu covers, which became a signature of the restaurant as a who's who of artists, from Ross Bleckner to John Cage to Francesco Clemente to Eric Fieskel donated artwork, usually in exchange for a dinner. The restaurant also had no dress code, at a time when Midtown dining places would have loaned gentlemen a sport coat if they arrived in shirt sleeves. The effect, wrote Waltuck, was our idiosyncratic take on a three-star French restaurant, such as could only exist below Houston Street in 1970s New York. The restaurant became a magnet for the slow-growing community of foragers and purveyors, including a young couple from New Jersey, proffering mushrooms, and George Faison, who was just launching the foie gras business D'Artagnan, with partner Arion Daguillon. Within a month, Green had penned a review in New York Magazine titled The Daring Young Man on Grand Street. Though she found the restaurant to be a work in progress, her enthusiastic appraisal declared, David Waltuck is not yet as brilliant as he intends to be, but when he is good, Chanterelle is astonishing. It was an apt study in the contrast between Green, a cheerleader for the new, and a proudly clinical Sheraton, who essentially panned the restaurant in an early review. Mimi was about what's on the plate and how good is this dish, says Peter Hoffman. Gail was into the theater and the experience and the cooking as an expression, the plate as an expression of the whole dining experience. Chanterelle continued to develop over the years, eventually earning 4 stars from Brian Miller in 1987. It moved to a new home on Harrison Street in Tribeca in January 1989, where it remained in business until 2009. Of the restaurants started by the 5 couples, the 2 that survived the longest rose the highest. You're thrown into a pot of boiling liquid. In an era when cooks and chefs improvised their careers, often in isolation, with no professional community outside of their immediate workplace, this cast of characters knew each other, with varying degrees of intimacy. I got to know Barry Wine very well, and I got to know Pritzker very well. And all these guys who all turned out were lawyers. They had the same stories, says Lederman. They kind of just organically fell into it. They wanted to cook. They thought they wanted to run restaurants. None of us knew what was involved in running restaurants until we started to run a restaurant. Even those who weren't friends frequented each other's restaurants, seeing in the other's kindred spirits, though not all of them felt the kinship with the group. I did feel a part of something, but not in a huge way, says Karen Pirro. We were aware that we were in the forefront of change that was taking place in New York and in the U.S. In Boston, we'd felt pretty much alone. Pirro was also keenly aware of Chez Panisse having been featured in a Harper's Bazaar article about Per Pirro, 2 women who were making it in the culinary world. The business also deepened some of the relationships while straining others. The Waltucks are still together today, as are the Ledermans. The Pritzkers broke up for good in 1982.
It's very hard to work with somebody 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and find that you have enough left to have an interpersonal relationship, says Pirro. Bob and I used to beat each other up a lot verbally in the kitchen. It's just a hard life. We didn't always see things the same way. Bob was very bottom-line oriented, and I hadn't really grown up enough to realize you own your own business for a profit. We used to argue over how many covers we'd do a night. I'd say we can't do more than 60 a night, let's say, because the shit's going to hit the fan, and then what? And he'd say, look, we have 4 loins of veal sitting in the fridge. Couples in the best of situations don't have to see eye to eye. When you're working together with someone, you really have to toe the line the same way. And we didn't.
Of running a restaurant with his partner, Bob Pritzker says, you're thrown into a pot of boiling liquid. Swimming together in it is not for everyone. Swimming alone in it isn't for everyone. And it's a forum for differences. There's so many things to disagree on suddenly. The friction showed in the dining room.
I was very friendly with Bob and Karen until they were getting divorced, says Lederman. That became uncomfortable. The last time we went to that restaurant, we walked in and Bob sent us a bottle of wine, and Karen came to the table and took it off.
He and Bob did remain friendly enough that after Dodin Buffon closed, Bob helped out in the Manhattan Market kitchen during a staffing shortage. Things boiled over in summer 1982. The Pritzkers separated in June and closed the restaurant for the month of July. Pressured by friends and fans, they reopened in the fall with a schedule designed to keep the peace. They hired a maitre d' to take over some of Karen's front-of-house responsibilities. Karen prepped all day. Then Bob showed up and honchoed the kitchen at night.
We did that for 3 months, and it wasn't viable, and we were in the process of getting a divorce, says Puro. And the press picked it up again. They'd have to at that point. I was over the marriage, so I didn't take it personally.
Puro went on to work for restaurant consultant Barbara Kafka's Star Spangled Foods, then became pastry chef at Tavern on the Green. Bob went all in on the bachelor life. I was suddenly a liberated New Yorker, and I acted like one with women. That was fun, he says. I burned both ends. I worked 12 hours a day, but I found women everywhere, often in my dining room. I don't know that chefs were in their great moment at that time, but if you were in your basement kitchen and some lady or 2 ladies were at a table and one was delicious looking, as the chef thanking them for coming and hoping that they enjoyed everything, that was not the last sentence. That was not the last question, you know? There's an awful lot of stuff that could happen. The Wines, too, had a tempestuous relationship. Barry and Susan were often at one another's throats, says Josh Wesson. If you worked on the floor, you were stuck in the middle. Her role there was running the front of the house, but Barry also did some of that. She never went into the kitchen, but he came out and would butt heads with her. Of the dynamic, Susan Wine says,
we were married for 29 years. If we hadn't been in business together, living 3 shifts a day, we'd still be married. We burned it out.
She also says that it was only on their day off that she could reflect on or enjoy their success.
When we were out of the restaurant or out in New York City, or rebuilt our country house and had people out there, then there was a certain amount of basking, but never when we were in it.
Until 2009, when Chanterelle abruptly shuttered just shy of the restaurant's 30th birthday, David Waltuck used to crack that of the 5 couples, he and Karen were the only ones that were still in business and still together. The marriage endures, as does the Lederman's. The last gasps of that enchanted moment when a couple could cobble together a restaurant from pluck, passion, and a few dollars, honed their craft for paying customers in the public eye until, suddenly, improbably, they had all of New York City eating out of the palms of their hands. 3. On the Waterfront.
My dear fellow, who will let you?
That's not the point. The point is, who will stop me? Ayn Rand, The Fountainhead. Against all odds, how and why Buzzy O'Keefe built a restaurant on the Brooklyn side of New York City's East River, and, just as improbably, discovered a succession of great American chefs, Larry Forgione, Charlie Palmer, David Burke, continuing to thrive as they graduated to Manhattan. Buzzy O'Keefe was a fussy, his word, kid, with a passion for quality that informed everything he did. How fussy? Well, most of his friends made slingshots from an old Y-shaped branch in a bicycle tire. Buzzy fashioned his from maple, stained and lacquered it, fit it with a length of medical tubing, sheathed it in a leather pouch. He decorated his boyhood bedroom. He built himself a dock, one that could withstand any storm, kept a boat there, varnished it to perfection. "I was always into getting the best," he says. In 1977, O'Keefe, who had owned several hospitality businesses by then, completed his crowning achievement, a glittering European-style restaurant that floated on a barge just off the fringe of Brooklyn Heights, with a peerless panoramic view of Manhattan. The restaurant became a runway for three of the defining American chefs of the 1980s, Larry Forgione, Charlie Palmer, and David Burke, who succeeded each other in that order, each setting forth his own distinct style of contemporary American food. All three attracted significant media coverage, then alighted to successful careers as chef owners in the promised land of Manhattan across the East River. The chefs became household names. O'Keefe did not, but don't be confused. The story of the River Cafe is ultimately Buzzy O'Keefe's story, and the chefs, while unmistakably talented, owed their big breaks to his good taste and keen palate, and to his unquenchable thirst for perfection. Finding the peach and not messing with it is the real problem. O'Keefe was born in the Northeast Bronx, an Irish-American kid in an immigrant-rich community. Don't ask him where the nickname Buzzy comes from. It was conferred on him as an infant. He didn't know his real name was Michael until grammar school. His family didn't have much money, but O'Keefe recalls a comfortable childhood. His mother kept a garden that he admired, and they could afford an occasional restaurant meal. He found the hospitality business early. At 16, he worked at Schrapp's on Fifth Avenue, one in a chain of candy shops and lunch counters, where his mother had been a waitress. By the time he was halfway through Fordham University, he had eaten at La Caravelle and La Grenouille, his favorites, and at the Four Seasons, and the other dominant restaurants of the day. He loved their physical beauty, especially the murals at La Caravelle, painted by Versailles native Jean Page, whose brushstrokes also graced the walls at Le Minois and Lessines, among many others. O'Keefe served in the United States Army, then took a job as a sales rep for a California-based food products company for which he was willing to fly coach, stay in cheap hotels, rent a Chevy instead of a Cadillac, as long as they would foot his bill in the finest restaurants. His supervisor got the better end of the deal because, outside New York City, O'Keefe couldn't find destinations that met his high standards, usually settling for a steakhouse. O'Keefe prided himself on being a gentleman. He threw parties to which he invited more men than women, but if the men got fresh, he'd banish them. "He's out," he says today in imitation of a baseball umpire, jerking a thumb to indicate the door. He resisted drugs, even at parties where crystal sugar bowls brimmed with cocaine, and he wanted his establishments to be drug-free. In everything he did, quality was paramount. Years before brand-name chefs and blog-inflated butchers elevated burgers, O'Keefe made a study, soliciting wisdom about the optimum fat content, and embarking on a personal odyssey in search of the best bun. "I tested every hamburger roll from Philadelphia to Boston," he says of that road trip. "Who had the best hamburger roll? It turned out to be Arnold. Just a little sweeter." He was also a dreamer. In the mid-1960s, he hatched a scheme worthy of Bugsy Siegel to open a restaurant on a barge on the East River, on the unfashionable outskirts of the Fulton Ferry Landing on the Brooklyn side, with a panoramic view of New York City, before the Twin Towers, which would be completed in 1973, added to the landscape. Appropriately enough, another restaurant visionary, Joe Baum, ran Windows on the World atop the North Tower, with views that stretched to the horizon line. "I always wanted to serve good food, nice surroundings," O'Keefe told me over a breakfast interview at the River Cafe, after he miraculously brought it back from the pounding it took by Hurricane Sandy in 2012. "I only did this because I could have a garden, too. I was into gardens. The city's pretty harsh. So I figured I'd make an oasis where New Yorkers could escape without having to drive 50 miles. O'Keefe is a lean man of indeterminate age. A fellow writer warned me to not ask him his birthday, which is a well-kept secret. He's an immaculate, conservative dresser, and as exacting about that as he is about everything else. He was actually 45 minutes late to our interview because he said he hadn't been able to locate just the right cufflinks for his ensemble. During the years he lobbied the city for permission to build the River Cafe, he opened other restaurants, including Bowdoin Square, a nightclub in Southampton, Long Island, which he operated from 1973 to 1978. Drug use was peaking, and he didn't care what people did in their Ferraris or Lamborghinis or in the potato field across the road, but he did care what they did in his joint. It didn't take narcotics to put him off. If a party of 10 showed up in tuxedos and evening gowns and one member was chewing gum, the entire reservation was canceled on the spot. To this day, the River Cafe, just minutes from where you can tuck into 3-star New York Times meals in shorts and t-shirts, requires that gentlemen wear jackets after 4 p.m. O'Keefe had a shot at the space that became Studio 54 in 1977, but turned it down because I didn't know that many nice people. After a decade of persistence, the city relented and granted O'Keefe permission to build his dream restaurant. But he couldn't find a bank to back him until a childhood friend, an executive with a New Jersey bank, helped push through a loan. "All you need is somebody with some balls," says O'Keefe. O'Keefe had traveled to London and Paris, eaten in their finest restaurants, modeled the River Cafe on those settings. Stone flooring, rattan chairs, flower arrangements, fine china. His culinary leanings were almost Californian in their purity, the default being to fête great product. If I give most young chefs who want to do peaches, say, in August, a peach dessert, the biggest problem we have is finding the perfect peach with just the right sweetness and juiciness. It's hard to find. Some seasons you don't get them at all. 99 chefs out of 100 will take that fresh peach and poach it. They can't leave it alone. They must put some magic to it, which I disagree with. And they will make it taste exactly like a canned peach with all their magic. I said, "You take it, you slice it, you lay it out like flower petals, a tiny little bit of sugar on top, sprinkles of water, just let it sit there for a little while, develop its own syrup, and you serve it with a very high-quality double cream. You get high-quality heavy cream, shake it halfway between whipping, just pour it on." People might say, "That's all it is? A peach?" Yeah. Try to find a peach. Finding the peach and not messing with it is the real problem. To satisfy his lofty demands for great product, O'Keefe developed a network of purveyors, including a fisherman in Everglades City, Florida, who periodically shipped him stone crabs on ice via Eastern Airlines, and another on the Peconic Bay, who sent him scallops 2 or 3 times a week. He even sourced venison from the Rockefeller Estate in Sleepy Hollow, New York, instructing the hunter where to shoot the poor beasts, and how to hang them, and for how long before he sent his man to pick them up. He hired Rick Steffen, a Culinary Institute of America trained chef, but by 1979 was on the hunt for a new toque. Why was this not taking place in America? Larry Forgione, then going by his more formal name, Lawrence, grew up in a different borough than O'Keefe, but had been on his own compatible evolutionary path as a chef while O'Keefe was making his bones as a builder and restaurateur. Forgione was born on Long Island, spent his early life in Queens, New York, one of 4 children in a middle-class family. One set of grandparents was Italian, the other Irish, so family gatherings were a fixture of his childhood. His Italian grandmother had a self-sufficient 5-acre farm on eastern Long Island, where Forgione spent every other weekend and extended time in the summers. His Irish grandmother was a devoted home cook, one of these women that got up at 6 and went to church, came back, put an apron on, and didn't take her apron off until she went to bed at night. "She just loved cooking," says Forgione, who was especially fond of her little dessert buffets, featuring at least 5 home-baked pastries, cakes, and pies. His Irish grandmother had been a farmer who moved to Queens to raise Forgione's mother. The Italian grandmother was a Brooklyn seamstress who ended up on Long Island in later life.
The upshot was that both sides of the family knew good food and good ingredients. Even as a kid, Forgione understood that he had it better than his friends, with Sunday feasts regardless of which grandmother hosted. His Italian grandmother was good at sneaking in foods like snails and rabbit, and not revealing what they were until they were in the kids' bellies. Much as he loved food, it never occurred to Forgione to become a chef. As a child, he considered the priesthood. After graduating high school in 1970, he went to college with plans to become a physical education teacher, because teachers were exempt from the draft. When pneumonia put him down for a semester, he killed time working for a cousin's Brooklyn catering concern. He loved it. When the next semester rolled around, he skipped school and kept the job. He worked at the Breakers Hotel in Palm Beach, Florida, took to the professional kitchen setting, learned some classic techniques like ice carving, came back north intent on becoming a chef, and applied to the Culinary Institute of America. 2 years later, after graduating the CIA, Forgione wanted to get to Europe, mailed a letter to Michel Bourdin, chef of Maxim's in Paris. By the time the letter got to Bourdin, he had migrated to London's Connaught Hotel and offered Forgione a job there for £25 a week. Forgione signed on for 6 months and took a room in the staff dormitory. He ended up staying 2.5 years, working his way up to chef du parti, doing time on every station except pastry in the resolutely classicist kitchen. In London, Forgione experienced something he'd never witnessed in the United States, the direct link between farming and foraging and restaurant kitchens. "It was the first time I had seen baskets of wild mushrooms showing up at the back door, brought by the foragers. We could get a load of lamb from Kent every, say, Thursday. Fish that was just impeccable. Produce that just was the most perfect things that you could want. The Connaught bought only the best. And it started to make me think, America is so big, has so many different regions and terroirs. We have mountains. We have streams. We have rivers. We have oceans. We have hot climate, cold climate. Why was this not taking place in America? Why were even the best French restaurants in America using canned chanterelles from France? And in my stupidity, naivete, it was, don't chanterelles grow in America? It just started to bother me. Why were they getting such great ingredients? And back in America, we weren't getting great ingredients. You were getting a sheet of paper handed to you by your purveyor, and if it was on the paper, you could get it. If it wasn't on the paper, you couldn't get it. You never made a request because you didn't have it. You always got cauliflower wrapped in plastic. The food universe was very small in such a huge, magnificent country. So the real thing came to me when there was a shipment of poularde du Bresse, and all the French guys, everybody, were acting like we were about to have a religious experience. The chef cooked it, he sliced it, and gave everybody a piece. I just remember putting it in my mouth and saying, wow, this tastes like my grandmother's chickens. It tasted like what chicken should taste like. It was at that moment that something popped. From that moment on, when I tasted a strawberry, all of a sudden I could recall the flavor of my grandmother's strawberries, or my other grandmother's sweet peas. It was almost a cosmic thing. When Michel Girard blew through London to promote his new book, Cuisine Monsieur, Bourdin set Forgione up with a gig helping the great man. Girard offered him a job at Eugénie-les-Bains, but it was scuttled due to a government crackdown on foreign workers in Michelin-starred restaurants. A response, according to Forgione, to complaints that there was a shortage of quality jobs for young French cooks because of a new phenomenon, the influx of American and Japanese aspirants willing to work for nothing. So Girard dispatched Forgione to New York and Regine's, for which he was a corporate chef. In 1977, Forgione reported for duty at Regine's, a nightclub co-owned by Regine Zeilberg, dubbed Queen of the Night by the New York Post, and situated in a 20,000-square-foot space in the Delmonico Hotel at 59th Street and Park Avenue. For the young chef, it was a culture shock. Regine's was something I had never seen before. It was what I would consider a three-star restaurant up until 10 o'clock at night, and then the walls opened, and it was this international disco. There was a Lucite dance floor, neon hearts, and a non-stop parade of bold-faced names, Jack Nicholson, George Hamilton, Mick Jagger, Brooke Shields,
future United States President Donald Trump. Andy Warhol mingled about, tape recording conversations with the in-crowd. When celebrities came in, they always snuck them in through the kitchen, says Forgione. So we had this constant parade of celebrities coming through. Cheryl Teagues. All the bad boys of tennis, Bjorn Borg, John McEnroe, Jimmy Connors, the Mick Jaggers. Everything from musicians to sports figures to movie actors to television stars like Telly Savalas. Forgione cooked food right out of Cuisine Monsieur. The book was a sensation, but some customers would complain about portion sizes. We had problems with the one little stuffed chicken leg. People would complain that it wasn't an American portion, even though the leg was stuffed with truffles and sweetbreads. At Regine's, Donna Summer hits, love to love you, baby, throbbing the walls. His disappointment over the state of American product boiled over into full-blown frustration. He decided to do something about it. No small feat in a pre-internet age. My process of looking for ingredients was to first think about where they would be grown, or could be grown. I knew that my grandmother grew delicious basil and so on. By trying to sort of be local, I would find some place on Long Island that grew herbs. I'd say, well, can you grow these herbs? And they would grow these herbs. I think the first things I started working on were mushrooms because it really bothered me that we didn't have mushrooms. And so I would research chanterelles. Where would they probably grow in America? What matched that scenario? Morels. Same thing. And then the process. Since you couldn't type in online morels in America, you would have to do some research. What I would then do is, say, find out that wild hickory nuts grow in the groves. The biggest part of where they grow is Indiana. So I would actually call a town in Indiana, speak to their chamber of commerce, say, hey, do wild hickory nuts grow in your part of the state? And they'd say, no, it doesn't grow in our part, but you should call such and such. And then you'd call them, and they'd say, no, but call this person. And then you call that person. Then you finally got to somebody who said, oh yeah, we have more wild hickory nuts than we know what to do with. You should call John Dolan and talk to him. And then, next thing you know, we had true American wild persimmons, or hickory nuts, or true American chestnuts from a little grove of chestnut trees. Morels came from the Pacific Northwest. And then I learned that the people that are interested in mushrooms are what's called the Mycological Society. So I'd start calling mycological societies, and they would put me on to people who they knew went out and did it. It was a process. This was, no exaggeration, the beginnings of the extravagant sourcing network that's just a mouse click away from today's East Coast chefs. And Forgione says that he spent good chunks of most workdays in this pursuit, but it wasn't with history or legacy in mind. At the time, and I think you'll find this universally amongst all the chefs of that era, I just wanted great ingredients for myself. I wasn't thinking of it as, oh, this will make me rich and famous. I wanted the best possible ingredients I could get so I could cook the best food that I could make. And I always had an inquisitive mind, and I was dogged in my pursuit of things. It kind of sounds corny, but it's that expression that Fernand Poin is famous for. You can't have great food without great ingredients. I don't think any of us were doing it to become famous. It just happened. We were doing things that we believed in, that we loved. Forgione eventually became chef at Regine's, fashioning his own menus after the master's guiding principles. When Gerard visited, he was shocked. He couldn't believe that we had great fresh herbs, ducks that were not the processed American standardized Long Island duck, that we had some game birds, that we had some incredible vegetables and fruits and so on. He was blown away that this existed in America. Forgione remained there for close to a year and a half. Then, through Lynn Bean, a pastry chef he used for catering gigs, who also supplied the River Cafe with its superlative pies. As in L.A., house-made desserts were not a given in New York City restaurants. Heard from Buzzy O'Keefe about the prospect of taking over the kitchen at his Brooklyn restaurant. They met at O'Keefe's Pear Trees restaurant at 1st Avenue and 49th Street. O'Keefe shared his aspiration for River Cafe, that he wanted it to, says Forgione, be a world-class restaurant, a very important restaurant. He thought that it was one of the most beautiful restaurants in the world, but hadn't discovered any culinary voice or tradition. I told Buzzy that if he'd leave me alone, I will give you one of the best restaurants in New York within a year. O'Keefe hired him. When I first got there, it was kind of helter-skelter, says Forgione. It was the type of kitchen where people would be running over here and putting salad dressing on. It wasn't where the chefs designed and created everything and served it to you. To quote Craig Claiborne, the River Cafe is, at best, continental cuisine, but from a continent that we have not discovered yet. Forgione wasn't kidding when he told O'Keefe he wanted to be left alone. He painted a box on the floor from which he expedited during service. I didn't want anybody coming in my box, says Forgione. The front of the house couldn't enter my box. If they wanted to talk to me, they had to talk to me from outside the box. Though there's often a tension between cooks and servers, the box was not normal kitchen protocol. Forgione himself laughs sheepishly when reminded of it today. Forgione and O'Keefe differ about who deserves credit for the American vision that took hold at the River Cafe and quickly came to define the restaurant. Larry is also very fussy, says O'Keefe. When Larry first came, his training was all in French, CIA, and then he went to work in the Connaught Hotel in London. And it was a famous French chef, Michel, whatever his last name is. I met him a few times. It was all French. We told him we were building an American restaurant. So Larry's menu was all in French. He's here practicing for a week. And I said, Larry, American. Same thing, just in English. We were trained by the French. Great culinary artists. But we're an American restaurant. We're going to use the best we can of what's in America. He and I disagree on a number of things that happened in the beginning, says Forgione. I can hear the conversations. He must have heard a different conversation. Yes, Buzzy always wanted it to be an American restaurant. But there's American restaurants that serve prime rib and O'Brien potatoes, and there's American restaurants that serve some of the best food in America. So it was true that Buzzy, the only thing he knew, was American food. He was using this woman that made pies because she made great apple pies and cherry pies and, you know, really old-fashioned American desserts. So yes, he did want it to be an American restaurant. Concurrent with his change of venue was an evolution in Forgione's vision for his own cuisine, which he decided to take in an American direction, in part because he was jingoistic, but there was another reason. You listen to so much shit from everybody when you're in Europe about how Americans don't know anything about food. They don't know how to cook. That American cuisine is hot dogs and hamburgers, and haute American cuisine is steaks and lobsters. And as I started to research it and read about it, it was just so full of incredible ingredients, things that you didn't hear about anymore. It was a cuisine of great home cooking. But so are a lot of other regional cuisines. So I always felt that I could take something as simple as mashed potatoes and make great mashed potatoes, and they would be fine on a menu at a 3-star restaurant, a high-caliber, serious restaurant, that it was okay to do that. That really was the backbone of what was going on with myself and Buzzy. I think that it really solidified the River Cafe as one of the great restaurants. As part of his mission, Forgione wanted to develop a relationship with James Beard. I thought that if I was going to get involved with American cuisine and take this position that I think American food and American cuisine can be world class, I should know the person who I feel is the most important figure in American cooking. Mutual friend Stephen Spector, co-owner of the Japanese-inflected Nouvelle Cuisine restaurant Le Plaisir, where chef Masa Kobayashi ran the kitchen, suggested that Forgione simply ring up the icon, pointing the chef to the white pages. There it was. James Beard, West 12th Street. So I called him up. He actually answered the phone. I told him a little about what I was doing. I don't know if he got these calls all the time, so what I started to do was, as I was getting in ingredients, I would make this little basket and then have the driver deliver it to him. I'd send him a basket of morels, or I'd send him some wild hickory nuts, just different foodstuffs that I know that he hadn't seen in a while, with a note, "Wonderful morels from northern Michigan. Have fun with them." Eventually, he picked up the phone and called me and said, "I'd like to come over and have dinner." Forgione was so blinded by Beard that he doesn't remember who joined him the night he first came to the River Cafe. He sent out significantly more food than was promised by the pre-fee 4-course menu. I had happened to just get a shipment of illegal bear meat in from a Native American tribe in northern Michigan, says Forgione.
Native Americans in northern Michigan up in the Upper Peninsula. They were allowed to trap and hunt freely, but they just want the pelts and the skins and so on. They didn't really want the meat. So my future partner at American Spoon Foods, before we had American Spoon Foods, was a wild foods forager, and he would get the meat from the Native Americans and send it to me. So I happened to have some bear meat. I cooked it up, and he just went crazy because he hadn't had bear meat in God knows how long. River Cafe became the first restaurant to serve buffalo in New York since buffalo became extinct. I think he enjoyed tasting things that he hadn't tasted in a long time, and that excited him. He seemed to have a good time. We talked a little bit. He left. He said, "Let's talk again." And one thing led to another, and we started talking all the time on the phone and in person. Instead of sending the driver over with a little basket, I'd go over with a little basket, and we just developed this great relationship. Jim was bigger than life. He had fun in everything that he did. "Is that fun?" was a common statement of his. Or he'd taste something and go, "That's fun. This is really delicious. It's so much fun." He equated happiness with fun, and he got so much happiness and joy, particularly out of food. I was so excited to have the opportunity to meet him, and then connect with him, and then have this ongoing relationship with him, until he passed away. That I feel very fortunate. I used to sit with him at his townhouse in Greenwich Village, and we would just pull down books and read them and talk about recipes. He also had an incredible memory. Say you were talking about an antique apple. He could say, "Oh, I remember having that at such and such restaurant back in 1955. That was just so incredible." It was like he could taste it as he was talking about it. Forgione continued to expand his network, buoyed by the restaurant's brisk business and buying power, which enabled him to make greater commitments to farmers and producers than he could at Regine's. He also began serving chickens from Paul Kaiser, a farmer who raised them in a cageless environment. In one of their periodic meetings, searching for a succinct way to explain them on the menu, he and O'Keefe came up with a designation that became legendary. Free-range chickens. Helen Chardick, a young cook from Buffalo, New York, who had spent time at Chez Panisse, then returned to New York City, came to work for Forgione, found him a big, generous, gentle man. This is not the chef who's walking around yelling at everybody. This was a man who knew what he was interested in, knew the kind of food he wanted to make. Having spent time in California, she was especially impressed by his sourcing. "When you walked into the little office there, there were reams of papers of who was making what, where the mushrooms were going to come from. I kept thinking, oh my God, this is gold. If I could somehow get all of these purveyors, this is where it's at."
11 months after Forgione took the helm at River Cafe, Gull and Mio's New York Guide came out, naming the River Cafe one of the best 5 restaurants in town. It was the only American restaurant on the roster. I'm not sure if I felt shocked since I was so completely overjoyed. Mission accomplished kind of thing. It was hard to believe that I was accepting an award standing next to Andre Soltner, who was the biggest chef in New York, the king of kings in New York. Forgione began meeting other members of his generation, who were making their names around the country. Jonathan Waxman, then chefing at Michael's in Santa Monica, popped in for brunch with fellow Chez Panisse alum Mark Miller. Alice Waters, on Beard's recommendation, appeared for dinner one night. Waters and the New Orleans chef Paul Prudhomme had bonded in 1979 at a Food and Wine magazine first anniversary event at Tavern on the Green, at which Prudhomme stole the show, and he and his army of cooks bailed Waters and her sous chef Jean-Pierre Moule out, helping them cook and plate a lamb dish. Waters, Forgione, and Prudhomme developed an ongoing telephone support group. Ed Fertig, a Culinary Institute of America extern at the River Cafe in the early 1980s, remembers Forgione gathering the troops around, speaking to them of contemporaries such as Waters, whom he himself was learning about for the first time. Just as Forgione had had an epiphany in London, Fertig was awestruck by the foodstuffs delivered daily to Forgione's door.
"I saw things I had no idea about as far as product. When guys would show up like Paul Kaiser with the chickens, I was like, wow, you mean he just drove up here like at 5:30 this morning and brought us chickens? It was surprising to me. I worked with the butcher for a while. I was the guy eviscerating these things and breaking them down at 7 in the morning. They were still warm. If Nouvelle Americana doesn't seem like the foodstuff of hip New Yorkers, Borgioni didn't think it was either. The River Cafe under any of the chefs was still a highly tourist restaurant, he says. Our main clientele was people not from New York City. And I don't mean that it was a tourist attraction, but in a certain sense it was a tourist attraction. Where else could you sit and look at New York, this beaming, glistening New York, the lights of downtown, at the time the World Trade Center and the Statue of Liberty off to the left? It was a postcard. Forgione felt that he had helped put the restaurant on the map, though he admits that was only in my ego, nobody else's. Nonetheless, he wanted to be made a partner. O'Keefe's reply, "How much is that worth? It's like giving somebody a couple $1 million, you know?" "I don't know how you'd calculate it," says O'Keefe. "Maybe you have to go on your own," O'Keefe told him. This, to borrow a phrase from O'Keefe, took balls. The fate that befell Patrick Terai at Ma Maison in its post-Puck period typified the emerging industry dynamic. Restaurants closely associated with or dependent on one chef rarely maintained the same level of prominence after the chef departed. Those that survived risked being engulfed by a fog of anticlimax. The moment presaged what would become a recurring theme at the River Cafe, as chefs inevitably wanted to become owners. "I would always be happy to see them succeed," says O'Keefe. "Some owners got mad when the people left. I said, I'm providing the stage. This is like Carnegie Hall, Lincoln Center. You dance, and then people see you and you're finished." After Chef Kobayashi decamped Le Plaisir for California, owners Steven Spector and Peter Joston didn't need the money and didn't want the headaches of maintaining the restaurant. They came into the River Cafe one night and told Forgione to fork over half his life savings, and he could have the restaurant. A deal was struck, and Forgione began planning his next restaurant with a name suggested by Beard himself, An American Place. It was the Wild, Wild West. The River Cafe sputtered along for months with one of Forgione's sous chefs stewarding the kitchen, until O'Keefe was put onto a new prospect, Charlie Palmer, then going by his more formal given name, Charles, chef of Westchester County's Walkabout Country Club, where he'd been recruited by members seeking something more refined than the typical continental fare. Palmer, a broad-shouldered, Hemingway-esque former high school football player from the dairy community of Smyrna, New York, had first discovered cooking thanks to a neighbor who was also his school's home economics teacher. From a young age, purely out of necessity, Palmer found himself at her house, making pies and such. And because we were hungry, not because we had any interest in cooking. Back in that day, the guys took shop, did woodwork and machinery and stuff like that, and the girls took home ec and they learned how to keep a household, says Palmer. So she came to me with this idea. "Hey, take this class. You're just going to cook. You don't have to do any sewing. And think of the possibilities. It's you and 26 girls. Not a bad thing for a high school football player. And you get to eat everything you make. So you can bring in all the stuff that you hunt and we'll cook it. We'll learn how to cook it together in class. We'll bring in rabbit, bring in venison." The classes led Palmer to a job at the Colgate Inn, just for money, really. But the teacher convinced him to consider the Culinary Institute of America, driving him there for his interview. After the CIA, Palmer worked at Le Cote Basque in Midtown Manhattan, then for Georges Blanc in Bonnat, France, an hour north of Lyon. The enterprising Blanc, whose reach extended beyond his eponymous restaurant, opened Palmer's eyes to the possibilities of his chosen profession. Seeing a guy that was literally running a hotel restaurant, owned other businesses in the little town, kind of owned a town, in a sense. I was really impressed with that whole thing. Palmer, who started at the country club in 1982, followed the goings-on in the New York City restaurant scene, and identified with Forgione's River Cafe M.O. Because he was given free rein in his new position, "I thought this is a chance for me to experiment with kind of incorporating this Americanization of French cuisine and make my own style." After a year and a half, Palmer missed New York City too much to stay away. He had met O'Keefe through Mark Sarrazin of DeBraga and Spittler, a meat purveyor,
who told him to expect a call from the restaurateur about the River Cafe job. The call never came, but Palmer pursued O'Keefe. Months of thwarted meetups and interviews followed, a canceled dinner at the Quilted Giraffe, a planned dinner at which Palmer found himself dining alone with O'Keefe's girlfriend. "It was to the point where I thought, this guy's crazy," says Palmer. "This is not going to happen. It's not intentional with Buzzy. Knowing him as well as I do now, it's very hard for him to make a decision. It's very hard for him to move on from something. I love Buzzy. I would say I'm probably one of his closer friends slash chefs over the years, but he's a different animal, man. But I think he always struck me as, like, an interesting guy and obviously successful guy. I always thought it was just a genius move to put a restaurant at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge looking at New York. I always thought that takes real foresight, especially at that point when he first did it, because it was literally the ghetto over there." Palmer persisted, arranged a face-to-face meetup, told O'Keefe to give him a shot and fire him after 4 months if he wasn't happy. O'Keefe agreed. When Palmer showed up to work 2 weeks later, nobody in the kitchen knew he'd been hired. It was, says Palmer, very rough. The chef, who still hadn't negotiated his own salary, fired 4 cooks in the first 3 weeks, brought on his own trusted lieutenants, some from as far away as Westchester County, promising them he'd work out a good situation. "We basically turned over the whole kitchen in the first 4 months," says Palmer. "There were 3 guys that stuck with us out of the whole crew. It was not a good scene. And there was a lot of animosity. I don't know how it all started, but I suspect it was a lot of communication breakdown. And it was dysfunctional. But here was a restaurant with people coming in every night, so it had to work." The saving grace was Palmer's quick rapport with maitre d' Rodney Garbato and his front-of-house team. "Some of those people really embraced me because they had not had that relationship with Larry. When I showed them some respect and said, 'Look, we're going to make this place better than it's ever been,' they bought into it." When Palmer broke out the turpentine and had the box erased from the kitchen floor, it was taken as a symbol of solidarity. Palmer carried the lesson into his future endeavors. "It doesn't take long when you're a chef and you become a restaurateur to realize that your money is made out there," he says. Under Palmer, the River Cafe kitchen underwent a constitutional transformation, morphing into one of the most macho, upscale backs of house of 1980s New York City. "I always hired these young, smart-ass kids from New Jersey or Long Island because they always had the best attitudes," says Palmer. "They could take a lot of shit. They could work hard. They were good, young, smart kids. I just filled the kitchen with these guys. It was the wild, wild west," says Palmer. "And we had that reputation, too." He's not kidding. The crew became known as hard-working, hard-drinking, rambunctious. "I wouldn't call it a serious kitchen in the sense that you don't look at the guy next to you," says Palmer. "It was more, let's work on things together and throw ideas back and forth. It was an incubator. There was an idea a day that made it onto the menu. There was no stopping that process. I think everybody had the feeling that we could do anything. We just had to put our marks to it. I didn't feel at that point that we had any boundaries. You know, in French cooking, there's the classical recipe. You follow the recipe. You respect it. And there we had this good understanding of cooking, but we didn't have any boundaries. There wasn't anything that said you couldn't combine this ingredient with that ingredient. It was a time where, maybe to a fault, almost every plate had to have 2 different cooking methods. It was rare beef with fully braised something or other, or lamb or veal, that kind of thing. We'd hear about something, read about something. We'd bring in monkfish liver. We'd make monkfish liver pâté, cure it. We were curing sausages. We were doing all that stuff way back then. A young cook named David Burke, referred to Charlie Palmer by Chef Waldy Malouf of Bedford, New York's Le Cremalet, where Burke had been a sous chef, came to the River Cafe as a sous chef in 1985, on the same day Jerry Hayden, a student at the CIA, began an externship there. Burke and Hayden were fast friends, trash-talking each other's place of origin, Hayden from Long Island versus Jersey boy Burke. Hayden was a bit swept up in the image of Palmer as a coach. "I never saw Charlie in anything but his whites," he says. "He came to work in his whites and he left in his whites. He was all business.
and he loved the fact that women loved to see men in a chef's jacket. He found Palmer's lifestyle aspirational. He was all of 27, and he was living in Brooklyn Heights on Hicks Street in this fabo apartment with Roederer Cristal and great art hanging on the walls. The days of the career grunt, just there for the paycheck, were starting to phase out. Every cook in the kitchen, it seemed, wanted to be a chef, creating an addictive relationship to cooking. I swear, all we did is get up in the morning, get coffee, go to work, leave that night, go to bed, get up, says Hayden. From the day I went in there, every day was amazing, says Neil Murphy, a self-described knucklehead and fine dining know-nothing when he was hired. Every day I learned dozens and dozens of things about cooking, about myself, about other people, about equipment. The food was amazing. The camaraderie that we had over time was amazing. If I wasn't with that group of guys, I probably wouldn't be where I am today, because we were so into our craft and so into cooking that it just took over our lives. It was more important than our girlfriends or our wives. It was more important than getting stoned. It was more important than drinking, although that was a priority as well. I never experienced that really in life that much. Nothing was as intense as that.
Murphy credits Burke as a catalyst at the River Cafe.
As fun as it was working for Charlie, Dave Burke was really the guy who brought it all together, he says. He was the guy who would go out and talk about food, talk about different things that we could do. He always had an active imagination. It was fascinating to hear somebody talk about food this way. Then we'd come in the next day and try some of these things, and we were actually able to get them on the plate.
It was still a European technique, says Burke of the American style at the River Cafe.
It was different names.
They call it steak au poivre. We called it black pepper steak. We're serving local fish instead of Dover sole.
Cooking is cooking. It's still cooking the European way. We're sautéing. We're grilling. Instead of a brandy sauce, we're making a bourbon sauce for the steak. It's not that much different at that stage. We're buying fiddlehead ferns. You'll never see that. Charlie's buying stuff from local purveyors, stuff which Larry started. Charlie's putting some menus together. They're not hyper-creative yet. Him and I together, I'm doing specials, but not all of them. Charlie writes them too, but then I get to write them. As time goes on, I start writing more. We made a very good team. We were making Maxim potatoes, overlapping slices, brushed with clarified butter and baked. Back then, we were trying to do them, and it was so hard to do. We had too much oil in the pan, and it was so hot, and there was no Silpats, says Murphy.
Dave was fascinated with consommés. We made all kinds of consommés. Who even makes a consommé now?
I remember doing brunch. He would have 6 mini English muffins with 6 quail eggs and 6 types of hollandaise. Can you imagine prepping for that?
We were down for that. It didn't matter. We'd come in early for that. And we got paid a shift rate. Nothing was hourly. So it was $78 a shift. And the shift could be 8 hours or the shift could be 16 hours. It didn't matter.
This is now becoming our life. If you were worried about the money, then you didn't fit in. And the universe was going to kick you out.
Of the English muffins, Hayden recalls that one day at brunch, early in the morning, we decided we were going to do quail eggs Benedict. So we started making English muffins. Nobody in that kitchen had ever made an English muffin. Okay, you pull out the books, you figure it out. So we're making this little griddle. It wasn't on the menu. So anybody that ordered anything, we sent out a few quail eggs Benedict as a starter, just to see if people liked it. Just this little half muffin with a little tiny over-easy or sunny-side-up quail egg on the top with a piece of bacon we were smoking in the back. Stuff like that would happen all the time.
I was a why-not guy, not a why guy, says Burke. Here's why we do onion soup with Ruyere cheese. I'm like, well, why does it have to be only onion soup that has cheese on it? Why can't I do a minestrone with cheese on it?
Hayden recalls Palmer and Burke as something of a Lennon-McCartney duo. They would always try to outdo one another, says Hayden. I remember Charlie made a cold lobster soup. It was made with shells, cream, tarragon. It was fucking phenomenal. But it was cold. And he served it with poached lobster and a beautiful, almost like a tarragon tambal, like a custard. It was so elegant. It was very reminiscent of something you'd see in a Georges Blanc cookbook. That blew me away. That's when I knew he was the chef that everybody thought he was.
There were a lot of times where the cooks on the line would say, "Hey, Charlie, I was reading this article last night about morels. Do you think we could get some morels in?" And the next thing you knew,